Hello, you're listening to On The Point, the News Collective's show, formerly known as Democracy Watch, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs coverage from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. I'm Isaac Yu.
I'm Joshua Azizi.
I'm Akshay Kulkarni.
I'm Grace Jenkins.
And I'm Alex Trabulsi. It's Friday, November 20th. We're broadcasting remotely nowadays, but we're based on UBC's Vancouver campus, on the ancestral and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. Today we've got an interview with Sarah Sagai from the Vancouver Tenants Union to talk about the rent freeze announced by John Horgan, as well as the VTU's demand for an eviction ban.
We'll also talk about the new restrictions announced by Dr. Bonnie Henry, including mandatory masks and the places that are not mandatory.
Plus, we'll chat about the new VPD community policing team and Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart's move to decriminalize simple possession of drugs in the city.
But first, let's listen to the interview Isa did with Sarah Sagai from the Vancouver Tenants Union. Isa, can you tell us about why you wanted to speak with Sarah?
Sure. So the Premier John Horgan announced a freeze on rent increases until the end of 2021 a week ago, but the Vancouver Tenants Union said that was the bare minimum and put out a letter demanding that the province do more, including an evictions ban. I decided to speak to Sarah to find out why this was the case and what the province as well as the City of Vancouver could be doing to help out renters during this pandemic. Sarah was really interesting and I learned a lot from her. I hope you do too, so let's have a listen. Let's get started. Could you please introduce yourself for the recording?
Yes, for sure. My name is Sarah Sagai. I am a board member of the Vancouver Tenants Union, and I've been involved in tenant advocacy at VTU for the last 3 years, in general, doing tenants and home housing advocacy for the last 5 years in Vancouver.
So John Horgan announced last Monday that the province would continue to freeze rents until the end of next year. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, I think it's interesting because VTU and other groups have been calling for a rent freeze since at least 2 to 3 years before this pandemic hit. There was a time where calling for a rent freeze was called a very radical thing. Or that's at least what we kept hearing from the politicians. At the same time, many tenants and members that we talked to told us that it's rent freeze is too little too late. And what we actually need is a rent rollback to control this runaway rental market. That was the situation before the pandemic. So even then, in reality, for people's lives, a freeze on the increase does not really do much because the rents are already way too high. And that's what we kept hearing even back then. I should clarify this. I think a lot of people, when they hear rent freeze, they think it means a freeze on paying rent, which is what we want, of course. But it's it actually is just the freeze on the 2% or so increase that is allowed annually. And there's another problem with this the declaration or announcement about the freeze, which is that it's actually not a complete and universal freeze. The landlords still can increase the rents between tenancies, which we think is actually the main source of the increase in rent that we see. Most of the increase in rent happens at tenants' turnover, not necessarily annually for the same tenant, although that happens a lot as well. Landlords tend to use all the opportunity that they can to increase the rent, including using the maximum allowable increase. But the main reason that we have an out-of-control rental market is not because of the annual increase, is because of lack of rent control between tenancies. So that's something that this announcement does not address. That's a big gap. I'll tell you why it's a big gap. We are worried that it will actually incentivize evictions. We are in a situation where the main concern that tenants have, or two main concerns that tenants have, is one, rent debt that they've accrued since the beginning of the pandemic. A lot of people lost their jobs. About 20 to 30% of the population across Canada went on CERB this year. So that's, imagine before the pandemic, the average one-bedroom rental in Vancouver was over $2,000. Now imagine having your income, imagine renting a place, relying on an income that could afford that rent, and then suddenly having your income reduced in the best case of scenarios to $2,000 a month. We did a survey, VTU did a survey of our members, about 400 people responded to it, which showed that about 70% of the respondents did not think they could afford a payback of the rent debt that they've accrued. And about 30% reported going hungry in order to pay rent. That's a really inhumane and cruel situation that we're putting a lot of people in. I hear landlords talking about how they have costs too, and they have to run a business and it has to be profitable for them. I think we're in a situation that we need to look beyond individual profit. We need to look at what is best for the society when we're taking care of people during this health crisis. And that's not what I see. That's not what I hear in the kind of discourse that we hear around housing. A lot of people have had their income seriously reduced as the result of losing their jobs in this pandemic. And at the same time, landlords expect to receive the same profit, the same revenue. I think the rents, the revenue that landlords receive should also be adjusted according to how much people's renters' incomes have been lowered as a result of this pandemic. So basically the rent debt and the threat of eviction are the two main concerns that tenants have right now. The increase that could possibly happen on top of that rent. Well, I mean, we're glad that's not going to happen for existing tenants right now. Although, as I said, because people are accruing these rent debts and because the province lifted the eviction ban, which is a major, major problem, then when landlords see that they can't maybe get their full rent from a tenant who's lost, they can't increase the rent either, but they can evict the tenant, and they can also increase the rent on the turnover for the next tenant, then that's actually an incentive to get rid of a lot of people. We really hope that this government acts before they have a full-blown eviction crisis on their hands. That's the thing that we worry the most about.
So could you explain the eviction ban requests and the VTU's demands?
We did have an eviction ban until September this year, and that was something that a lot of different countries were using as well. It also existed in the States, and it seems just like common sense, right? No one should lose their homes during a pandemic. Somebody's home is their first line of defense against the virus. We're hearing Dr. Henry talk all the time about, self-isolation and so on. Imagine not having a home. There are over 100 people camping at the Strathcona Park since this summer. And in this weather, I don't think anyone wants to live outside. I think everyone needs a shelter. But the reality is that there's just no options. There's no housing being offered to people who are on the streets. And that's a public health crisis as well as a housing crisis. We think the government needs to step in and provide housing for everybody who needs it. We have a situation where the 90% of our housing is private. I think the cracks are going to start to show now that we have this public health crisis on our hands, on top of the housing crisis that we had before. We think the government needs to step in and build a lot of housing. You can start by by increasing shelter spaces. You can start by building a lot more modular housing. And you can also start by taking possession of the housing that already exists and bring it into public possession in order to actually use it to house people instead of having housing sit empty as an investment, as a form of investment. So our demands are for the province to reinstate the eviction ban. We need rent control and rent freeze at tenant turnover. That's a really, really big gap. And I'm surprised that they're not even talking about it when they say rent freeze. They do not mention that there is no freeze on turnover. And of course, we want the freeze for the rent increases to be in place, not just until July, but past that, all the way until full economic recovery has happened. Very important, we need rent debts to be canceled. People cannot afford to pay back the rent during a time that they were not making an income. That's just, it isn't logical, it isn't humane, and it's a recipe for disaster.
So how do you feel the province and Housing Minister Selena Robinson has treated tenants over the course of the pandemic?
Well, I would say they've tried to do the bare minimum. We have seen the Housing Minister do a lot of press conferences in conjunction with Landlord BC, for instance. And I think that shows that their interests are in protecting the profits of landlords first and foremost, rather than taking care of people who might lose their homes. And we think those are those priorities are out of place. They should be reversed. You should take care of people and put them before profit.
So to shift focus a little bit away from the province, how do you think the city of Vancouver is handling tenant situations during the pandemic?
It's a little hard to evaluate the city's full performance on this issue. One reason is that the city has only limited, jurisdiction or control over what sort of housing, for instance, in terms of actually providing housing. The city can't do much, especially they've had a lot of, they've lost a lot of revenue as a result of this pandemic. In terms of sort of a tenant protection that the city needs to do at the times of evictions, that's something that does not apply to someone being evicted for not paying rent. That's something that applies when a development is happening or a renovation is happening. But we are in a crisis situation. We're in an emergency situation where a lot of people could lose their homes simply because of not paying rent. And there is no law that protects you from that. The only thing that could protect you is just a social lens at this problem rather than an individual lens, and putting people before profit. It's true that people are losing their homes because of not paying rent, but that's not due to the fault of their own. That's the first thing that needs to be understood. I think it's hard to say what the city could actually do, except they could help with providing more shelter spaces. They could, even though their revenues have been reduced, they could still spend more on providing sort of affordable housing in spaces that the city has control over for people who need housing.
Could you talk about what you do at City Hall when it comes to advocacy?
Yes, for sure. So there is a whole range of things that city does or has control over or could potentially do. Some of the things that I just talked about fall into that range. And a lot of it is, like I said, with this pandemic, we've entered a sort of an emergency situation. So a lot of it would not necessarily apply to the kind of crisis we have at our hand right now. For instance, one thing that we've been advocating for for the last couple of years at the City Hall is for the city to use the business license in order to not allow renovictions to happen. So one thing, according to the Residential Tenancy Act, the landlords can evict tenants without cause for three reasons. Two of those reasons is for demolition of the rental unit or renovation of it or major renovation of it. The third reason is for landlord's own use of the property. And the first two have caused a major crisis of eviction in this province for the last few years. And we think that happens because of greed and because of seeking profit. The city has a way of putting a damper on that. It has a way of increasing the cost of evicting tenants just to increase rent or to lose or stop the loss of affordable housing and stop them from being replaced by either high-end luxury rentals or by condos. So some of the things that we've been advocating for is for the city to actually regulate landlords using the business license bylaw in order to make sure that if a tenant is evicted, for instance, they for renovation or demolition, that they are allowed to return to the unit at the same rent or at similar rent rather than at market rent, or to make sure that the tenants are taken care of in the period in between. And one really important thing, which I mentioned earlier as well, that we've been advocating at the city level as well as the province level, is what's called vacancy control, which is what I was mentioning about rent control between tenancies, which is a major gap and a loophole in the RTA, that we have rent control, but it only applies to the tenant in a unit. Doesn't have to be that way. Rent control can be on a unit regardless of tenant turnover. That's a model that similar to a model that exists in Montreal, for instance, if a landlord wants to increase the rent for the next tenant, they have to explain why. They have to provide, maybe open their books and show why their costs have increased, that they have to increase the rent. We don't have that. We simply give landlords a free pass. We just assume that they have a lot of costs and they need to increase the rents year after year, tenant after tenant, by as much as they want. This has resulted in a completely out of control rental market. And the city can use its powers to tie rent control to the unit or provide a mechanism that resembles that, that in effect creates a similar restriction.
So that's the end of all the questions I have. Do you feel like there's anything else that you want to bring up that I might have missed?
I think I said everything I want to say. I'll just say that when we think of landlords, we really need to think of corporations and large businesses rather than small mom and pop landlords. When you look at the kinds of situations that people, that tenants are in this crisis, in this pandemic, most of the times they're the sort of the worst kinds of behavior comes from the companies and the large corporations rather than the small landlords. Those are the ones that need to be regulated. The number of mom and pop landlords, what we call mom and pop, which is like somebody renting out maybe a suite in their primary residence, that's a very, very small number when we look at numbers across Canada. Something like 8% of all landlords fall into that category. But in BC, the majority of landlords we're dealing with are large corporations, and they make huge profits. They're making really huge profits, and that should not be made on the backs of working class tenants who have lost their jobs and who are scrambling to get by. And we just hope that the government opens their eyes to this reality.
All right. Thank you so much for speaking to me.
No problem. Thanks for talking to me.
What is this?
CITR 101.9 FM.
A center for ants!
What?
We're a radio station broadcasting from UBC Vancouver.
How can we be expected to teach children to learn how to read if they can't even fit inside the building?
Visit citr.ca.
Derek, it's just a...
I don't want to hear your excuses! The center has to be at least... 3 times bigger than this!
The Carnegie Community Action Project is based out of the downtown east side. We work to help people fight gentrification, increase the welfare rates, as well as to fight for the rights of the people of the downtown east side. Please join our cause.
Please come to the CCAP volunteer meetings every Friday at 11:15, the Carnegie Community Center on the third floor. Thank you very much.
Housing now for the Oppenheimer homeless.
ATIRA Women's Resource Society supports women and children impacted by violence by building and operating a range of safe, affordable housing and related support services, including childcare centers. ATIRA has housing and programs across the Lower Mainland. Our feminism is inclusive and intersectional. We envision a world free of inequalities where everyone's human rights are respected and where women and girls have the right to participate fully and effectively in all of the decisions that affect their lives. To find out how you can help, please visit our website at atira.bc.ca or follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Free of Violence.
Welcome back to On the Point, your source of alternative and undercovered news from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. You just heard an interview with Sarah Sagai from the Vancouver Tenants Union. Let's talk about another long-running issue in our favorite city, crime and policing. The Vancouver Police Department has recently created what they call the Neighborhood Response Team, which is aimed at responding to low-priority calls. This week, a collection of Vancouver poverty advocacy groups have called for the police board to halt the deployment of the unit. The Western Aboriginal Harm Reduction Society, Pivot Legal Society, and Vancouver Area Network of Drug Users, known as VANDU, said the unit will discriminate against people struggling to survive on the streets in the city's downtown. With the examples they've given out about what low priority is, it's mostly... One example was a dude riding a bike without a helmet, and it turns out the bike was stolen. Or a guy who was... I forget specifically what he was doing to be stopped by the police, but he had an outstanding warrant for theft over $5,000. So it's... They've got... With the examples they've given, it sounded more like they've gotten lucky than actually stopped crime.
Yes, and there's something to note is this unit, so actually Vancouver, I'm actually going to be doing some proper data analysis of this, but Vancouver crime numbers almost throughout the city are actually either down or pretty much the same as last year. I think the VPD released new statistics specifically around Strathcona Park and other areas which show it's up, but anyway, whatever, I'm going to do some proper analysis of that. But the impetus for this unit wasn't like that, wasn't like worsening crime. It was a survey which the VPD conducted, which basically surveyed only 755 people, and less than half of them actually live in Vancouver. And I mean, the survey found that overwhelmingly people thought the crime situation was worse, but it's a bit of a weird one. Let's just put it that way. We don't know what's going to happen with this complaint from Pivot, WAHRS, and VANDU, but let's see. This is going to be an ongoing issue, and you know, we might have some more about this next week. So on the topic of sort of criminalization and the war on drugs, there's something else happening in City Hall right now.
Vancouver Mayor Kennedy Stewart introduced a motion in council yesterday to decriminalize simple possession of drugs within the city. If the motion is passed, Ottawa would have to approve decriminalization within the city for medical purposes. Council has to approve the proposal, and the next steps would include Vancouver Coastal Health coordinating with the VPD on how to implement the policy. This would include working out details like the exact definitions for personal possession, quantities, means for different substances.
So if this was passed, this wouldn't like outright include major legislative changes because it is just one city. It just would likely just be approved by, you know, the federal health minister allowing an exemption for personal possession under the Canadian Drug Services Act, I think. In much the same way, I don't know, it's the CDSA. In much the same way that overdose prevention sites operate when it comes to the grace that they're given. And Mayor Kennedy Stewart has said that this would be an important move in focusing on addiction as a public health issue and not a criminal one. So just for some context, right, 1,200 people have died from overdoses in 2020, which is actually likely an underestimate considering, you know, how many other underlying health conditions a lot of people suffer from. And that's just compared to a little less than 300 for COVID-19. So the scale is not even in the same ballpark. And the mayor has said that decriminalization would be used along with other continued harm reduction measures like safe supply or, you know, overdose prevention sites. And, you know, as he mentioned, that he wants to reduce stigma with this decriminalization. I mean, all of this is like good and all, but the VPT is technically like done this already. Like, they rarely prosecute for personal possession. But if this goes through, they won't be allowed to seize drugs anymore. So that's the major change when it comes to the enforcement side of this. So I want to hear everyone's thoughts just before we go for another quick break. So we saw, a little few weeks ago, Oregon, the U.S. state of Oregon, decriminalized drugs within the whole state. And they also want to move people away into harm reduction services. And I saw a lot of chat on this, about Mayor Kennedy Stewart's motion on Twitter. And, you know, people like Garth Mullins were saying, this is good and everything, but is it even going to pass? Is it, in practice, is it going to be a good thing? Like, is the VPD going to still crack down on drug users as they, you know, as they're doing right now? So what do you all think? Is this going to work out?
I hope it does. I mean, we don't really know if it's going to work out. I mean, we do have the sort of the benefit and the downfall of how our criminal system works, which is the feds set criminal laws and they put it down to the provinces, whereas in the states, it's the federal government has laws and the states have their own criminal laws, which bit of a interesting way to do it, but I'm not an expert on their constitution, so I'm not going to make any assumptions about that. Basically, it's not necessarily...
Go ahead. As an American, it's not a good system. I will make an assumption about that.
Thank you. But yes, for us, it's easier to decriminalize drugs because you just have to ask the Fed to go, hey, can you stop doing this, please? And again, it's also... could literally just be as simple as the Crown Prosecutor being like, no, we're not going to prosecute these, it's a waste of our time, when we have like more serious things to focus on than someone who had X amount of substance Y. So I don't, if it'd be sort of like putting what's already happening on paper, pretty much. At least that's the way I see it.
Just a quick correction of something I noticed earlier. Akshay, you were saying that COVID deaths are in BC are just below 300. They're actually at 320 now, so they're increasing, but still the point stands that overdose deaths significantly higher than COVID deaths in the province. The kind of questions with Kennedy Stewart's motion, like, will it pass in council? I definitely think it's going to pass in council. I know there's a lot of political diversity on council, but I think they're all pretty united in knowing that the overdose crisis is not a criminal issue, it's a public health issue and such. The big question is, will the federal government or the Trudeau government, will they give this exemption in the Controlled Substances Act? I think that's, I'm like really like, I don't know if they're going to or not. Like, I think they might. They're definitely hesitant about full decriminalization. And Trudeau he openly says, no, this isn't something I want to do. But just doing it for the city of Vancouver, I think he might be open to that, especially given that in Vancouver, the crisis is especially bad. And maybe he could see it as like, you know, we're hesitant to do this countrywide, but maybe we would want to just try it out in this one city. So I think it's definitely something that he might be like, yeah, sure, we could try this out.
Yeah, and obviously Trudeau and Kennedy Stewart have both said this is not a silver bullet. This is not going to solve everything. So, like, they're sort of already saying that. But, like, I mean, if you don't put the measures in place, then, I mean, it's not going to move. The needle isn't going to move if you don't do anything.
And, I mean, nothing's a silver bullet anyway. Yeah. Like, why are they saying this isn't a silver bullet as if it just disqualifies doing it in the first place? It's not a silver bullet, but we need a full magazine. So let's start putting some bullets in it.
Yeah. What are you about
saying? That was a very American saying.
It's great. Thing to note, there was this survey recently, I believe, from the CBC, which showed, I think, less than half of Canadians support for decriminalization. But, I mean, if you trust, like, I don't want to get into, like, sociology, but, like, 50 years ago, if you poll the public about gay rights, they would say the same thing. So, are we really gonna, because, like, this isn't being put up for referendum or anything. This is a legislative motion that probably will be passed in council. Like, this is the elected officials doing what they were put in place to do. So, like, I mean, maybe vote for someone else next time. But, yeah, that was a poll that the CBC conducted. And, I mean, if entire states and entire countries have done this in the past. Portugal has done this. They've decriminalized drugs throughout their whole country. So it isn't like this is radical from the city of Vancouver. But it's certainly something, I guess. But it needs to be accompanied by more. It needs to be accompanied by way more than just this. You know, like, entire attitudes and mindsets need to change. And hopefully this is the start of something. So on that note, Josh, you want to chime in something?
Oh, yeah. I think the only thing I was going to say was I haven't seen the CBC survey, but if that survey was countrywide, then I think if you narrowed it down to even just British Columbia, it would probably find a greater proportion of people in support of decriminalization, not just because the province is generally seen as being more progressive than the rest of the country, but I think on this issue, people definitely are, and it's also just worse here. Like, and so I don't know if it is, like, I don't know if it's as pressing in other parts of the country, though of course it's pressing everywhere.
I mean, it takes different forms, right? Like, I know in Manitoba and stuff, the methamphetamine crisis is pretty bad there. And I mean, opioids are especially bad here, but it's very much a case in the prairies and stuff also. So, like, the drug crisis takes many forms, and decriminalization, as I said, is just one sort of step to eliminating that, but we'll have to see how it turns out. So on that note, we take a quick break, we listen to some ads, and then we'll be back and we talk about COVID-19, which is obviously the backdrop to everything in our lives right now. So stay tuned to On The Point on CITR.
You're listening to CITR 101.9, broadcasting from UBC's Point Grey campus, located on the traditional, unceded Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people.
Have you heard about Megaphone Magazine?
It's an award-winning publication sold on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria by low-income and homeless vendors. When you buy Megaphone, you get entertaining and informative stories written by professional journalists, and you're also helping to empower people in poverty. Here's how it works. Vendors buy each magazine for 75 cents and sell them for $2, keeping the profits. With the money they earn, our vendors are able to buy healthy food, clothing, and other necessities, plus they forge valuable connections with their customers.
This year I earned enough income to take a trip to Victoria, meet lots of new people, and had an awesome time.
Don't miss out on this month's edition of Megaphone, chock full of voices and perspectives that you won't find anywhere else. Track down a vendor using our free Find a Vendor app, downloadable at megaphonemagazine.com.
UBC's Museum of Anthropology displays long-term and visiting exhibits of Indigenous art from around the world, and guided tours are free. Our permanent collection features one of the world's finest exhibits of Northwest Coast First Nations art. Our collection includes 36,000 ethnographic pieces, 535,000 archaeological pieces, and over 600 pieces in the Kroner Ceramics Gallery. There's a lot to take in. Luckily, at the Museum of Anthropology, final exams are always take-home. If you've never checked out this world-class facility, now's your chance. The Museum of Anthropology is located right on campus and free for all UBC students and faculty. Come enjoy our collection and resources.
Welcome back to On the Point on CITR 101.9 FM. Before we end the show, let's talk about COVID-19 here in British Columbia.
To start, Bonnie Henry announced as of Thursday that the province has seen 538 new confirmed cases of COVID-19. Another thing is that the public health order requiring that people only socialize in person with their core bubble, which for most British Columbians means members of their own household, has been extended another 2 weeks. The order was originally set to expire on November 23rd, but will now remain in place until December 7th. Starting November 19th, masks are mandatory in public indoor spaces in British Columbia. This includes grocery stores, shopping malls, and other indoor public spaces. However, and this is a big however, it does not include schools. So, what are y'all thoughts?
I'm struggling to think of the reason why they wouldn't make it mandatory in schools. It just doesn't make any sense to me.
If anything, if you were going to exempt something from being, if you had to pick one institution to require masks, I would pick schools, because lots of children and adults in a compact space filled with germs, just generally, especially during the pandemic. I think there's a false belief that children are less susceptible, but that they still get sick, and we should be concerned about protecting them as much as we can, especially since there have been signs that they can experience a different type of illness that we don't understand as much because of the virus.
It's also like kids are dirty. They don't wash their hands. Like, you know, they're like picking stuff off the ground. Like, I don't know. It just doesn't seem like a good idea to let them just like roam around and not have any like measures. Like, obviously there are some measures in place and they're doing the quarter system, at least in Coquitlam that I know of, but still, like, I wonder what's like stopping them from putting a mandatory mask order.
Yeah, I have not looked into the specific orders that Dr. Bonnie Henry put in, but there's already been outbreaks at schools. Like, I just, like, so, like, if it's, so, okay, in the hypothetical scenario where there were not any outbreaks in schools, even then I would question this order, because it just doesn't make any sense to me, considering, as Grace mentioned, there's literally compact spaces with children in them, right? But with the fact that there have been multiple outbreaks at schools, there was, I think, in Surrey, a school was literally shut down for 2 weeks because of an outbreak there, Cambridge Elementary, if I'm not wrong. I don't know what is not adding up for the province.
Just because children might be less likely to spread the virus doesn't mean that they won't, especially since they're going to be in person in schools. It's just like, it's basically the perfect, I'm not an epidemiologist, but it seems like the perfect place for transmission.
Yeah, and the hallways, like between classes, that's just, it's a hunting ground. Yeah, it's not good.
Yeah, I'm looking at the Global BC article that talks about why she's not putting in a mask mandate for schools. And I mean, I'm only just scrolling it quickly, so maybe I'm missing something important. But what I'm reading here is that she's defining schools as a different indoor public space than somewhere like a store or a government office. She says, schools are not public open spaces. You cannot go walk into a school. We have layers of measures of protection in places in schools. And like, I wouldn't wear a mask sitting in my office. We shouldn't expect children to wear masks sitting at their desks all day long. And I mean, if you're sitting, this now going to my personal take, like if you're sitting alone in an office, like, yeah, then I guess I kind of wouldn't expect someone to wear a mask. But children at desks, that's like 20 kids or maybe 15 kids. I don't know what the limit is for kids in a room, but that's still a lot of kids in a room. And even if they're still distanced, that's multiple people indoors. So I don't really get the logic there. And yeah.
Yeah, if kids were all sitting in their separate offices with doors closed for school, then fine. Don't wear a mask if they're in a separate room alone, but that's just, it's just not how schools work. They don't work in a way that's conducive to social distancing at all. So it seems like wearing masks would be the least they could do.
Yeah. I just like, so another thing that was brought up at the press conference was the idea of schools closing early, because as I said, we've already seen a school literally shut down because of COVID-19, and you know, schools closing early for Christmas so that, you know, kids have a little bit of a longer break so that, you know, they don't risk their lives going in every day. And you know, Bonnie Henry was like, yeah, you know, we're looking into that, but there are a lot of factors to consider. We'll have to ask the federal government, blah blah. So yeah, I don't want to speculate about a lot of things, right? But so the NDP government were largely re-elected because of the way they're handling this pandemic, in that they, you know, they were seen as sort of stable, and like Dr. Bonnie Henry really helped out in that regard, Adrian Dix, you know, appearing alongside her. And I think there was a little bit of talk, especially on you know, some people on Twitter, that the way that they're dealing with the school opening situation really wasn't helping them, and you know, that might lead to some gains for the Liberals. But you know, the Liberals ran a pretty bad campaign. We talked about this on the show. So this is pretty much, so a lot of things have gone wrong when it comes to the COVID-19 response in BC recently, right? Like, you know, I don't need to tell you, the cases have been exploding. So, and schools have sort of been the thing which it never really got better for schools, you know? Like, it from day one, there were exposures, there were all sorts of things. So is the sort of like the sheen of Dr. Bonnie Henry's pandemic response, is, will the schools be that, like, the one crack in that? What do y'all think?
I think if there's a crack, if anything, it's that cases have just risen so much. I mean, back in the summer, there's that New York Times article that says, you know, Dr. Bonnie Henry, she's the doctor that aced the coronavirus test. But like, cases have risen just so much here, but they've also risen kind of all throughout Canada. And, you know, definitely BC is doing better than other places in the world, doing much better than most states. I mean, somewhere like South Dakota, we're doing infinitely better than. But I kind of think the sheen has definitely worn off. Not to say that she's doing a bad job, because she's not. I just think that, you know, the sheen has worn off. Yeah,
it's, I'm just like sort of hyper fixated on this weird treatment of schools in the education system. It's like it's always on the back burner whenever it comes to policy. It's like, okay, so we have a plan for government offices, we have a plan for health, we have a plan for like public safety, what about like elementary and secondary schools. They're fine. We don't have a lot of cases there. It's fine. Don't worry about it. Like the
I think it also, sorry.
Like I was going to say, like the reasoning about like, well, not just anyone can access a school. Well, I mean, parents can get sick and then their kid can pick that up and then bring it to the class. Like it's not just some schmo just walking in the front door, just coughing on every single child they see.
Isa, I think you wanted to say something?
Yeah, no, I'm just like still reeling in embarrassment at having accidentally cut Alex off. But I think it has to do with like costs a lot, because when they were preparing, like I don't think they just ever considered, like this is all pure speculation. So if I am like, I don't know if I'm I'm going to get in trouble for saying this, but it's just my guess. As like a part of the population, I guess, is that I think it has to do with cost, because like moving online would mean like acquiring like technology licenses and stuff like that. And that's like, and if it's for like whole school districts, that's going to be like a certain amount of money. And then it's also, I don't know. My theory is that it has to do with like cost, and it's too much of a hassle to switch to online, because like for UBC, like we were able, like universities are all switching online, but you could technically say that university students are more likely to have like better immune systems compared to like children. That makes sense, doesn't it?
I don't know. I'm not an expert on disease and the immune system.
Yeah, I'm not an epidemiologist.
I think from what I've read, it's the idea is that because children are like physically smaller, they just don't produce as much of the virus as adults do. And that's true.
That's interesting.
It has to do with your metabolism, I think, and breathing. I could be completely wrong about this, but I'm pretty sure it's true. Don't quote me on that.
Please, whoever's listening to this, please don't treat us as gospel. I will just say that much. But yeah, go ahead.
It's like lung.
So I do think that there is evidence to support. I do think there's evidence to support that children don't spread the virus as much or get it quite as badly. But I don't think that justifies leaving them to fend for themselves.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah. I don't know. I don't get the real logic. I think a lot of it also has to do with childcare, right? Because school is often childcare for a lot of people. You know, because, you know, as working in essential service or working 9-to-5s, even 9-to-5s for some people, but they can't work from home. It's difficult to like leave your child alone, right? Like, yeah, I mean, a lot of the way school reopenings have happened all across the world have to do with this, because the way the state works right now, it's not like you can afford to keep your child at home. But anyway, let's not get into the too broad of a discussion here. But yeah, does anyone else have anything to say before we move on? So obviously we just talking about COVID-19, we could pretty much do it every week. But yeah, the school situation in particular and the way it was sort of singled out during, Thursday's sort of announcement about masks just stood out. And I'm sure we'll be talking more about schools in the weeks to come. So before we call it for this week, one of us has some news to share. Josh, take it away.
All right. So this will be my last episode on The Point, because I recently got hired as a news reporter with Bell Media in Prince Rupert. And in particular, I am going to be the Prince Rupert reporter for CFTK-TV, which is a Northwest BC television station, and which is owned by Bell Media. And I'm also doing news reporting for Easy Rock North, which is a radio station in Northwest BC, and Pure Country BC North, which is a country radio station in Northwest BC. So yeah, I'm very excited for this opportunity, and I'm going to be moving up there within like a week and a couple days.
Wow, just amazing. So could you just describe for the listeners your work on the show, you know, over 2 whole years?
All right, so damn, now I'm getting all reflective. It's gonna be all nostalgic and stuff. I first met Alex DeBoer, who was the former News Collective coordinator, back in April 2018. I went to write a UBC article about a podcast series that CITR was doing, and then I was saying to her, you know what, I should do some stuff at the CITR News Collective. This sounds cool, because I saw that some people from UBC's journalism school were doing stuff with it, and they were pretty active, so I thought, that looks cool. But I didn't do my first piece there until like 10 months later. I did a story on New Westminster City Council putting in new restrictions on rent evictions within the city. That was actually an interview I did with the city councilor there. Alex turned it into an episode of Seeking Office. That was pretty exciting. In April 2019, I did some episodes on a march that commemorated the anniversary of the overdose crisis in BC. I did some reporting on Vancouver City Council declaring a climate emergency. And then kind of over the past few weeks or the past month and a bit, I've been editing episodes of On the Point. I've been occasionally doing interviews with folks in the city about current affairs topics. It's been a good time. I've learned a lot about how to edit audio, and I'm looking forward to adventures in Northwest BC. But I should also add that the training I've got here has been excellent, and I feel like I learned a lot here. And for any for any up-and-coming journalists looking to expand their broadcast journalism skills at UBC, I definitely recommend CITR. This is me doing my little plug. All right, that's all I have to say.
Awesome. There is one more thing. What was your favorite piece you ever did for Democracy Watch? On the Point, now, as it's known as.
I wouldn't say that it's in particularly a favorite piece, but back when I was doing stuff, a fair bit of stuff here in April 2019, I worked on 3 episodes. One was covering Vancouver City Council declaring a climate emergency. The other was about the anniversary of the overdose crisis being declared in March. And another one, I wasn't on the show, but I did some audio editing for a interview that Alex did with Councillor Pete Fry about property taxes on businesses in the city. And like in that week, I remember like feeling just very productive, felt like I was learning a ton. And you know, in journalism school, you learn a lot, but you don't get a lot of hands-on experience. And I remember Alex saying at the time, like, this is how you get out and you learn about journalism. You just get out there and you do it. And I was thinking, you know, yes, because that's how I'm actually learning these proper skills. And it felt great to do it. And I have a really fun memory of that. And she was a great teacher. And I wish her the best with the future projects that she's working on.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like a lot of us owe a lot to her, and she's actually going to be on the Vancouver Podcast Festival this weekend. If any listeners are interested in that, you can go look that up. But it's not about her this week, though. It's about you, Josh.
I'm just paying tribute.
Of course. And it's been great working on the show with you. I remember working on the piece about the Indian protests. I think I tried my best to include you at the end. I think some things fell apart towards the end of that one, and I took a lot more than I deserve. But you helped me a lot in that piece, and obviously we've been working these past few weeks together as well. It's just been great. This show is much better for your contributions to it over the years. And I think we'll miss you a lot. You know, moving away from the city and everything, and I really hope that you get where you want to be. So I'll let other people also talk about that.
I hope so too. Anyone else have any other contributions?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, obviously congratulations. It's been great having you as an editor, and I think like the first thing we ever did together was a really dumb like ad for CITR where we put on some really goofy voices. So Congratulations.
I don't think that was me, actually.
I think it was. Check the tapes.
I haven't made any ads this year, but they look fun. So I definitely would have loved to do some.
Josh, this was a live ad that we did for Fun Drive. Do you remember that?
Oh my God. Yes. Wait, what was
it
the ad?
It was to yeah, it was merch. It was to get the toque, I believe.
I don't remember this at all.
You put on the best voice, and but I vaguely could remember not stop it now. Laughing. It was amazing.
The what
it
voice?
Was like a it was like a cartoon character voice.
that sounds like something I would do. I believe it now. I believe this now. I'm sorry for doubting you, Alex.
Is it my turn yet? Okay, Josh. Mm-hmm. Congratulations!
I got a fact
first of all.
Wrong.
Very nice.
Thank you.
I was very surprised to like get the phone call, and I was like kind of confused.
Yes.
But nothing but good things to say about your work ethic and whatnot.
Thank you.
Thank you for editing. That has really been so helpful and like made my life a billion times easier. And yeah, good luck.
Thank you.
Josh, I haven't known you very long, but it's been great getting to work with you. Wish we could have met in person at some point, but maybe in the future.
Maybe in the future, once all this, I'm doing big hand gestures in the air, once all this calms down.
Yeah, I hope you have a great time in your new job, and I wish you all the best in the future.
Thank you very much. And yeah, damn, I haven't seen, I mean, like, yeah, I saw Akshay, I think, back in the start of August. I haven't seen Isa since, February. My God. It's all
crazy.
Virtual now.
I think last time I saw you, was that at, like, Fun Drive or whatever at Redgate?
I might have been. Yes, I remember I was at Redgate on the 14th.
I don't know. That might have been the last time. Actually, did we have any episodes after that?
Potentially, actually.
Did you come to those?
I did some episodes in February.
I don't know if Josh was there. Yeah, I'm trying to remember. The time is a little confused in my head. But anyway, I think that's Isa's last thing was a pretty good end. So do you want to just take us out?
Good luck again. I know I already said that, but good luck. You're gonna need it. So that's it for our show. Thank you so much for listening. This has been On the Point by CITR News. We're here every Friday at 10 a.m. bringing you local news. And stay tuned for more amazing programming.